Welcome to our episode of A Push Anxiety Attack. Remember, if you enjoy this podcast, please do remember to review us on whatever podcatcher you use. You can also now catch us on YouTube, where you can listen to my beautiful voice while staring at an unanimated image of Richard Nixon. It's easy, when looking for simple stories, to think of the American Revolution as a sudden event. A point of about 4 to 5 years where the colonial population comes incensed, then angry, then violent, defeats Britain, and is then transformed into a new nation. We like to think that's what revolutions are, right? Sudden. But it'd be far more realistic and useful to think of the American Revolution in terms of, say, the Industrial Revolution, a process that happens over a long period, in this case, say, 100 years. And this isn't a radical break with the old, so much as a gradual evolution over time that starts with the Great Awakening and the crisis of religious devotion in the wake of generations born in the colonies, and a growing feeling of disconnect from the mother country, and ends in 1812 when the now nation of the United States elects of its own volition to go to war with Britain. Throughout this time, the country's developing challenges and concerns, then internally grappling and adjusting to respond them. With the end of the fighting, there are some of these adjustments that occur almost immediately. One of the most immediate ones is the enforcement of a clear separation of church and state. That's a term that gets thrown around a lot, but you have to remember that under British rule, there is no separation of government and religion. The king was the head of the Anglican Church. Today, the queen is the head of the Anglican Church. The bishops sit in their British House of Lords just because they're bishops. And thus, there's an intrinsic connection between these two entities. So in states where there had been an official church, where the Anglican Church had been the official church, essentially anywhere south of New England and Pennsylvania, it was disestablished, that is, disconnected from the government and ceases to receive tax funding. This also means that states where it had been a legal requirement for you to attend, as it had been in England for several centuries, would relax that requirement. It's important to note that this is not the case in New England, where the Congregational Church still held its position of great power. This is also, by the way, the point where the Anglican Church in the United States rebrands itself as the Episcopal Church to sound less like the Church of England than it is. It's also worth thinking about the immediate social and political issue. There's a gap created by the fleeing of 80,000 loyalists, and you lose a large amount of the more conservative side of American politics. Remember, many of these men had served in the local houses of burgesses, or they'd exerted social and political influence over the colonies, and now they're just gone. This creates something of a social vacuum, and it's important to think about why. Let's consider for a moment the trend among the socially and economically powerful towards a conservative outlook. It's not mysterious when you think about it. If you're in a position of power, if you have wealth, you're unlikely to want that situation to change. When you hear people throwing around ideas of equality, it's likely to make you pretty nervous. Because you have the power and wealth, how could they become your equal? You certainly don't want to share that power and wealth, because then, well, if you're rich and everybody else becomes rich, then you're not really rich anymore. Likewise, if you're powerful and everybody becomes as powerful, well, you're no longer powerful. Generally, conservative ideas of maintaining the current situation appeal to people who are happy with the current situation. It's worth noting also that these conservatives had genuinely felt threatened. Some members of the radical side of the revolutionaries were outspoken in hoping for a full-blown social revolution. There were mobs of Sons of Liberty marching in Philadelphia calling for a levelling of wealth and social class. And when they looked at who had been the primary victims of violence from the Sons of Liberty, well, it hadn't been poor people's homes getting burned. This obviously isn't true of all people of wealth and power. I mean, look at Jefferson. But it's certainly true of the majority of those 80,000 loyalists who were so happy with the current situation that when it was threatened, they literally fled the country. As for scale, that's larger than the 1776 population of Rhode Island that just up and left. There are cultural signs of this. One of the shifts in culture at the time is increasing desire for everybody to be referred to as Mr. and Mrs. Now, this might seem weird to us now, but this had previously been used mostly as a title for those considered as the respectable types. It was a distinction that said, maybe I don't have a noble title, but I'm better than the common riffraff. Now, everyone felt they deserved the title, and it was used as a form of equaliser. In fact, the biggest example is to come later when George Washington insisted that the president should only be referred to as Mr. President, not any noble-sounding title. There's an obvious conflict here between this mood of equality and the continued existence of, you know, slavery. And there's a growing enthusiasm for the anti-slavery movement. Some speakers of the Continental Congress way back in 1774 had actually called for the abolition of slavery, but they were essentially laughed out of the meeting. Quakers were the founders of one of the first abolition societies in America in 1775, and some slave owners were even moved to free their slaves in this new spirit of equality, though it was a tragically rare occurrence. While we're talking about equality, let's address the other elephant in the room. When Jefferson said all men are created equal, that was going to mean men. Women gained very little from this new tone of equality. Though a notable exception is my old home state of New Jersey, which created a new constitution that gave the vote to women. For a bit. It's such a good story that it bears looking at for a moment. When New Jersey created its constitution in 1776, they created a rule that limited the vote to all inhabitants who were worth at least £50 and lived in New Jersey for a year. Now, nothing in that restricts it to men, though it's worth noting that very few women were able to own £50 of property, since property rules were very restrictive and prevented married women certainly from owning anything. But to make it clear, this wasn't a mistake. In 1790, they clarified that this meant men or women. It's also worth noting that there's nothing here about white men or women. Technically, if you were black and had £50 of property, you could vote. And there are anecdotal records of this happening, even one record of a black woman voting. But this wouldn't last. In 1807, there was a panic about, stop me if you've heard this one before, voter fraud. And as so often happens, the easiest people to scapegoat were women and people of colour, so the rules were changed to only allow white men to vote. No one is surprised. Way to go, New Jersey. Probably the most important idea in this period, when it comes to rights and status of women, was a concept known as Republican motherhood. This is the idea that women in this new society have a very important role. They're going to raise the children of this new republic. The future of the country is in their hands. It's a powerful idea, but one with considerable issues. When you place women up on a pedestal, by default you place them in a trap, where women are all now held up to that high standard. Women are the shapers of the minds of the new republic, and thus, should any woman not live up to the standard we need from the shapers of minds of the new republic, then they're a threat to that new republic. If the ideal of republican womanhood is positive, the fear of not fulfilling the ideal of republican womanhood is shameful. As often happens, the supposed positives of this treatment of women is actually a way to extend and nuance their oppression. It's limiting women's value exclusively to their service as mothers, and places them in a precarious role from which they could very easily slip. In the 1776 Congress, the agreement was that each colony would write their own constitution, and this would be crucial in the way they would move from a colony to a state. Many of these new constitutions were quite similar. They were written documents. Now, I know that sounds obvious, but other countries had what they considered constitutions, but these were an accumulation of laws and rulings that together constituted a constitution. Here, the idea is to have one document that can be held up as the basis of all laws. Being a written document also makes them more unchangeable by the whims of kings or a legislature. They're more permanent and stable, though all contain within them some method for their own amendment. They reflected, in general, ideas of fundamental laws, and it's the same strain of Enlightenment thinking that we looked at in detail last episode. They often dealt more in generalities. Your constitution is a framework. Specific laws were passed within the state legislatures to explain how to do the things it outlines. Many of these state constitutions included a specific Bill of Rights, and this reflected elements of the British laws that ensured certain specific rights that citizens were guaranteed. Many also specified the need for annual elections for electors to keep the power held with the people, and for General Thomas Paine-like fear that rulers in power for too long become corrupt and dictatorial. They also all established a relatively weak executive, if any, a governor and a judiciary, or state judges. Again, echoing the mood at the time that the people and their directly elected legislature should be where the power lay in this new country. A good example of this feeling was expressed succinctly by Thomas Jefferson. When Virginia were arguing about the nature of their constitution and how long and in what manner representatives should hold power, he expressed that 173 despots would surely be as oppressive as just one king. You can also see this change in state capital in many cases. The previous seats of power in the colonies had all been along the coast, but now they move further inland. As we talked about before, the coastal towns and cities tend to be richer and more inclined to be loyal to Britain, while the further west you moved, the poorer and more politically radical people became. This also matches an increasing move west. With the Proclamation Line of 1763 no longer restricting it, Americans began a westward migration that would not stop until they covered the entire continent. There are some essentially conservative economic changes, remembering that new leaders were almost all taken from the highest levels of wealth and power in the states. They're not going to let those folks we talked about before actually level society. Obviously, the war did disrupt trade with Britain, and this caused an immediate issue of unemployment and shortages. But this drove domestic production of many of the goods they would have previously got from Britain. It's worth taking a moment to discuss industrialization and manufacturing here. While we will talk at length about the Industrial Revolution in the United States of America, it's really important to understand that this industrialization happened in Britain about 100 years earlier. By the time of the Revolution, Britain had been moving over to factories and increased industrialization for over 50 years. The growth in British manufacturing will continue throughout the 19th century, but it's partially fueled at this point by demand from the American colonies. One of the things you need to build a factory is investment. These new factories are expensive. But Britain had refused to charter any banks in the colonies, meaning there was no financial organisation to loan businessmen in the colonies money. In fact, Britain worked hard to suppress the manufacturing industry in the colonies, specifically to force them to buy from Britain. So when the colonies break away and this trade is disrupted, this left the colonists with an immediate need for manufactured goods. We should not overstate these developments, however. It will be some time before the United States develops the systems needed to build this industry. 90% of Americans are still farmers, but for now, Americans experience an immediate slump from that drop-off in trade. This potential economic issue was combined with considerable debts that each state emerged from the war with. Additionally, the Continental Congress had taken on considerable debt, which was doubly problematic because legally, well, what was it? Especially after the war was over and the Treaty of Paris, there seemed to be this big question mark hanging over the Continental Congress, and especially its currency. Inflation was a serious issue. The value of the continental currency was dropping continually, made worse by the concept that states might create their own currencies. Just to make sure we all understand this issue, by the way, inflation is when the price of items gets bigger. It inflates. And this is connected to the value of currency dropping. So an item that might have cost $1 one year might cost $2 a year later. This means the actual value of the dollar to buy something has gone down. It's a tricky word to keep track of because inflate makes it sound like it's getting bigger. Just remember, the prices are the things inflating, not the currency. So tearing down a nation is quite easy, but building a new one is quite challenging. And one of the largest issues around is just what this new entity is. Is it a single country with 13 regions, or 13 regions that are allies? This is not a problem that's going to go away anytime soon, by the way. It can be argued that the majority of those within the states identified as members of their states first. You might be a Virginian or a New Yorker, but it was unlikely your first instinct was to think of yourself as American. So the ideas of patriotism and independence were often framed in these terms. Independence for Virginia, through the medium of this alliance we're entering into to get rid of the British. And the Continental Congress was very much organized in this format. It was a meeting of independent entities that organized to accomplish things. Of course, the one exception for this, that we will speak about in coming episodes, is the experience of those who served in the Continental Army. These people may have become accustomed to identifying as American, to having fought under an American flag. Now, during the war, a committee had been formed to decide what format the new national government should take, and the decision was for a confederation. A confederation is a somewhat loose organisation. It's an arrangement of independent entities that come together to cooperate. A federal government would exist, but the states would retain almost total sovereignty over things that happen within their borders. This confederate government would really only be in charge of mutual defence and foreign policy. For example, many of the states did go ahead and create their own currencies and set up their own taxation systems. These Articles of Confederation would be the first American national government, and all 13 states needed to approve them. An immediate issue they ran into in this process was about claims to land in the West. Many of the states had pre-existing claims, and many of them overlapped. Maryland had no land west of the Appalachians, and felt it was very unfair that other states had claims that allowed them to move in and profit from this new territory. After all, Maryland had fought in the war to allow these lands to be taken, so why should states like Virginia move in and not them? But by far the best example of this is the dear state of Connecticut. Way back in episode 3, I talked about the king giving Connecticut a sea-to-sea charter in 1662. That gave them claims from the Atlantic to the Pacific. That would be a strip of land, 70 miles wide, running all the way from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific. That land would be the state of Connecticut. And by the way, a quick check of a map will tell you that land would run through both New York and Pennsylvania. Bold move, Connecticut. This not only led to states withholding their vote to approve the Articles of Confederation, Pennsylvania actually called up their state militia and sent them to the region of the border that Connecticut would have to take to make this work. The compromise that diffused all this can be seen as an interesting sign of where all this mess is going to end up. No state will own land west of their borders. This land will be owned by the federal government, not individual states. They would be responsible for developing the land into some form of states and adjudicating how they interact with each other. This is also the roots of the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, which sets out how the Confederation government would manage this land, including how new states would be formed. Two things of note in there, one being that slavery was banned in these territories, though any runaway slave would be returned to their owner. The second required the native peoples in these areas be treated with good faith and their lands and property not taken away. Now, neither of those is going to work out great, just saying. You also get the Land Ordinance of 1785 answering the question about the new lands in the Ohio Valley. Surveyors were sent in, and the land was divided into sections of 1 mile square. And then these sections were numbered, and six of them would be classed as a township. And these sections could be subdivided and sold, and these six would include sections dedicated to specific purposes. So one of those sections would be sold to fund a school in the township, and so on. What's important to know about the Articles of Confederation is it intentionally created a very weak central government that would be unable to take the role of a dictator the way they felt the British government had. For example, the government had no executive branch. There was a president of Congress, but he was literally just the chairperson of meetings. The power here rested with Congress, with the legislature, not any single decision maker. This Congress is also elected annually, so logistically this dramatically limits how much time Congress can actually be in session. You'd get elected, travel to Congress, make as many laws as you can, then go back to your states to campaign to get re-elected. All of this in a time before any form of rapid transport. All important decisions also required a two-third vote, so getting things passed was very hard. And to change the articles, you needed a unanimous vote of every single member of Congress. There were also some acts that the Articles of Confederation specifically prevented Congress from doing. Congress had no ability to raise an army. It had to rely on states to provide their militias. This despite the nation having just won a war with a continental national army. Congress could not put any taxes in place, nor could it regulate trade and commerce, which would mean taking in import and export taxes. Now, you might be wondering where this government would get any money from. Well, funny story. It would have to ask states nicely to voluntarily give it money. But wait, didn't we just say the states were in a ton of debt? Yep, so is Congress. So, some folks look at the Articles of Confederation and they see the positives. And they talk about the way it created a sense of national unity, and they see it as the seed of the future constitution. But I would argue the only way the Articles of Confederation spawned the US Constitution is by being truly terrible. They're so bad that they force the creation of the Constitution. Honestly, it took something so bad to make Americans agree to a dramatic change. Next week, we'll talk about the problems that occurred for this new nation operating under the Articles of Confederation, and how the combination of these issues led to the Constitutional Convention.